This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, bards, troubadours, and skalds, the musician archetype in speculative fiction.
So, this episode is going to be all about music, or more to the point, musicians. We've actually had an episode all about music in speculative fiction. So this is actually looking, the focus is a little bit shifted toward the musicians themselves and what roles they play in mythology and books and TV and all of those things.
Yeah, I was going to say they're sort of like a Greek chorus in a way. Because if you haven't got them as a main character, having a, particularly in fantasy, having a musician character come in just sort of fills in a bit of world building for a lot of different fantasy type books in particular.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is like the Greek chorus, but instead of having one person coming on or several people coming on and sort of chanting, oh, yes, we all know Hesiod married such and such, and then they had a child and it turned out to have the ears of a stag or whatever. you might have your musician coming on and say, oh, play us a song, please, and hops out his harp. The harp would be a different thing, burns everything down. That's the end of that request. Gets out his harp and perhaps sings the song of the Fisher King or something like that. So it gives you a little bit of background without doing a massive info dump.
Yeah. I think the premise is that we have to go back and really look at that link between storytelling and music.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, understand that bards weren't just musicians, they were storytellers, and stories were told with music. And there's a very practical reason behind that, which is that it's easier to remember things if they're put to music.
Yeah, very little was written down either, because in its absolute origins, it was, you know, writing was sacred and the law was sacred and you couldn't commit it to being written anywhere, which is why we partly have so few examples of the early Brythonic languages.
Yeah.
So they had to learn these great long passages of stories and tales and lore in the oral tradition, which it is still relatively accurate, but it wasn't written down. So they had extremely well-trained memories.
Yeah. And that music basically did allow for the stories to carry further and for them to be remembered. So it was an excellent way of adding an extra level of drama when you're telling the story, because you can add a lot of, you can add that undercurrent of feeling and emotion with music when you're telling a story, so that you had that, and it was also an excellent way of remembering things. Of course, back in the day, if we go back to ancient Ireland, you had the poets, and that also involved music as well.
It's quite a tricky one. There are the three main branches of, I suppose, what you'd call the late Dark Age, early medieval Irish poetry. I say poetry. I mean, it's some of it rhymes, some of it doesn't. Obviously, if you read it in Irish, at the I've found that I'm actually straining my understanding of written Irish at this point in time, because I'm reading through Berryman's The Midnight Court in Irish, and I'm reading bits, and then I'm finding these online translations just to check. I'm not going into Google Translate or anything like that, but I'm checking other people's translations, because there are some concepts that just don't translate very well. So I'm like, is that really what it's saying? And it's incredibly ribald and crude and very sexual in nature in places. And then someone in America has done a translation, and the paragraph is like, I'm sure that's not what that's exactly. I mean, you've kind of got the gist of it there, but that's really kind of skipping over the poetry and music of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Actually, he's got the fairy queen saying, well, if you haven't got that, then get out of here. And I'm like,
I think there's a little bit more to it than that.
It's like, Yes, that is kind of what she's saying, but it's a lot more scathing in our Anyway, only a little bit of that at a time, because apparently my written Irish is something that could do with a bit of a brush up. So that's fun. But yeah, going back, you have the three main types of, I suppose, song.
Mm-hmm.
There are the I can't remember the actual word. It's like Amrin, but not Amrin as in song, Amrin as in a long ode, which is about a wooing, if you mm-hmm. like.
Yeah.
The Trochera, which is about a woman running off with a younger man than her husband. Seriously, this is literally what they're about. And then there is basically the long heroic ballads, which generally involve a hero going off to sea and finding himself in the other world. Sort of like, oh, okay, I've kind of got a bit lost here and I'm in the abode of the dead. this didn't go well for me. But, you know, there's probably between the latter and, say, things like the Iliad or the Aeneid or the Odyssey, there's a lot more parallels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could say probably a lot of Latin influenced the third of them. We don't really have any examples of anything in the original Old Irish anymore. There's just fragments, which is a bit of a shame, but I think the spirit is still there.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's fair to say that music has played a huge part in our history, and that the role of the musician in storytelling has been vital from before recorded history.
Yeah,
I would say
definitely.
Now, if we kind of look in the modern age, you still do have that element of storytelling in music, but there has been a separation between the idea of storytelling and music.
Yeah, and a lot of that is to do with the written word.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Well, not everybody could read. Books were written as records and to a certain extent for pleasure as well.
Yeah.
Or to a certain extent, I mean, if you think of the philosophers and the Stoics like Marcus Aurelius, things like that, we had access to those after the Romans left.
Yeah.
Not. There weren't travelling libraries or anything like that. But, you know, if you happen to end up in one of the few castles we had as Saxons, then quite a few of them would have had a scriptorium where these sort of things were kept. And then monks started practising, and nuns, in fact, started practising calligraphy as an act of worship. So the sheer idea of recording something in written form, beautifully illuminating it, was in fact a prayer.
Yeah. And we did kind of separate a little bit from music there. Now, I don't want to talk about it too much, but I do kind of want to talk about music within religion as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that prayers and certain chanting, I mean, you get the musical element, which is in the Adhan in Islam.
Yeah.
You know, the calls of prayer. It's got a musical element to it, as do the call and responses in the church, in the Christian church. You have these musical elements in scripture because it's almost this idea that lyricalness, that melody heightens the word, if that makes sense. It makes it more holy. It adds another texture to it, which makes it more godly.
Yeah, there was an act of prayer in actually singing something.
Exactly.
So while the chants were often quite simple,
mm-hmm.
They were, you know, they were offered up as praise, almost like a libation, actually, but in song, because it was something that you were training and putting some effort into doing. It wasn't just, I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, but you know how perhaps as a child you learnt your Catholic catechism by rote and it was chanted as a doleful sing-song.
Yeah.
It used to be that all of those pre-Vatican II, all of those were actually sung in Latin, and you might not understand them, but they actually sounded better that way. No, I haven't. I haven't been alive since Vatican I was in operation. But my convent school did kind of cling to it a bit, so we did still sing a lot in Latin.
That's what an immortal would say.
I haven't been alive since the 40s. Not me.
Sure.
Yeah, 500. I just age really, really slowly.
So. Hey, I'm looking good. But yeah, it's the idea that music has a spiritual element to it and adds an extra layer to the spoken word. And that therefore the people who provide that, the performers, as it were, the people who share the story and the word, were in themselves a kind of spiritual being.
Yeah.
And we do sort of, there is still a little bit of a mysticism that comes with musicians. Because music is very, very difficult. And we look, for instance, now at professional musicians, so professional pianists and stuff like that. There is always an element of magic. And we always apply this element of magic to the arts in general, that it's not just about the technical side of things. There's an element of heart to it as well, and you cannot perform music well without adding a little bit of your soul into it. And it takes a specific kind of person to do that. And so whenever you see stories focused on musicians, it's all about them finding the balance between the technical side of what they're doing, but actually it's about them expressing themselves. And you see this time and time again, and that's because we have maintained that quiet belief that music is a little bit magic.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, if you've heard the saying, a real voice is born, it's not made. I mean, obviously people have training if they want to be a professional musician, but you know, there are people who genuinely are tone deaf or just have no voice whatsoever for singing.
Yeah.
And no amount of training gets rid of that.
No.
And the idea was that if you did have something like that, it was a gift of the gods and then later a gift of, you know, God. Therefore, it was something to be used. Although once you had the Latin church over here in the UK, how that was used, if you were a woman, was somewhat more restricted.
Yeah.
But certainly all priests were supposed to sing mass, and you know, that's something that carried on right up until quite recently in the Catholic Church. And if you had a priest who genuinely couldn't sing, sitting through mass as he sang it in Latin was, let's just say it was a real test of faith. And it had to be for the person, the poor bloke singing it, to be honest.
In my general experience, people who are tone deaf do not know that they're tone deaf.
Oh, I don't know. I've met quite a few who are tone deaf and they know they are. And they're either really embarrassed about singing or they just don't care. They just roll into it. And it's a case of, yeah, I know I'm off key. I've got enough awareness to know that I'm completely off key, but I just don't care at this point.
I mean, we could get into a debate of what tone deaf means. But, you know, as far as if you are aware that you're not singing it correctly, then you're not tone deaf. You're just bad at singing. But to be tone deaf, to be truly and utterly incapable, just means that you have no idea unless someone comes up to you and literally says, you are singing very badly.
Like, you are so off key. Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I think there are gradations of it, but
yeah.
There are definitely people who can't carry a tune in a bucket with a lid on it.
Yes. So, should we talk about some bards and some musicians in fiction and literature?
We've mentioned the three types of, you know, traditional Irish song in the sense of recording mythology. And in the Trocadéric, which is the young woman runs off with a... runs off with a younger man than her husband. She's been married to someone she doesn't really fancy all that much. Quite often the person who woos her away is presented initially as a bard. And a good example of that is Tristan and Isolde, which is actually it has parallels in Welsh mythology in the Mabinogion.
Yeah.
In Cornish mythology, in Breton mythology, I'm sure there's a French version.
Probably.
There's Irish. It's Arthurian adjacent as well, so it was sort of happening just around the same sort of time in some respects. Yeah, basically, Tristan disguises himself, ingeniously calling himself Tantris.
Wow, Tristan.
presents himself as a bard. I mean, he allegedly gets shipwrecked on the Cornish coast and presents himself as a bard. You know, they take him in, they look after him. And he said, well, you know, in repayment, I would like to entertain you. Sets eyes on Isolt, who is married to King Mark of, I think, Tintagel at the time.
Yeah.
In the tradition of bards and troubadours and skalds at the time, models the ideal of feminine beauty after the Lady of the House. But it goes a little bit further than that.
Mm.
And they end up falling in love with each other, although there are drugs involved, or rather a love potion is involved.
A love potion is involved, yeah.
Yeah, which kind of ruins the story. It's a great love story, to be honest. If you think about it, it's like, yeah, well, we both got magical roofied and then that was it for us, and then everything went wrong and she got burned to death.
Yeah.
Which is basically the way that goes. But,
yeah,
you know, presents himself initially as a bard, which is what starts the whole thing off.
It is interesting because actually throughout mythology, we have a lot of creatures that use singing to lure people away.
Yes.
So, I mean, the most obvious is that you have sirens and mermaids.
Yeah.
Which are different, by the way. And yeah, they would lure sailors to their deaths with their beautiful song, which sort of made them think. You have the muses who sang as well within mythology. Fairies, got to put it out there. Fairy music was often entrancing and would lead people into fairy rings or just into the world of fairy, where they would get stuck.
Yes.
Possibly eaten. Or most of the time they'd have sex with people and then they'd return and it would be like 500 years later and everyone they loved has died.
That's quite some session.
Yep.
Obviously the time difference, but yeah.
Yeah, you have Bragi and Norse mythology. This is the important thing, is that within every pantheon you have a god of music, or you have a bard character who exists in every pantheon because it was considered one of these high arts, and their music was meant to be enchanting, to the point that music has this ability within fantasy and within fiction to entrance.
Yes, and it's interesting in a way that in a lot of myths it's used in an almost political fashion to persuade as well.
Yeah.
If you think of Orpheus descending into the underworld to find Eurydice.
Yeah.
And the fact he pleads his case through music, and Persephone takes pity on him and intercedes for him with Hades.
Yeah.
Obviously that goes horribly wrong because it's a cautionary tale, so of course it does. But, yeah, the fact that music is, again, used there almost as a political thing.
Mm. Yeah.
And it crops up in various different places as well. You could take Achilles. Achilles is obviously known for total war.
Yeah.
But
he was also a great musician.
He was also a great musician. He was very, I mean, he was God-born, so he was naturally gifted at a lot of things. But he was naturally gifted playing the lyre.
Yeah. And that is actually another thing, is that many of the heroes within mythology they were great warriors, but they were also all great musicians.
I think this is where we get the slightly tongue-in-cheek, slightly half-sighing ideal of a warrior poet now.
Yes.
It's like, he must be an excellent swordsman and yet really sensitive with it.
But but it was the idea that it was also a manly thing to be able to cry and to be able to pour your emotions and do something so delicate as well. It wasn't seen as a kind of a girly thing at all, because music was a form of power.
Yeah, you look at further Irish and Celtic myths, they're Coca Clane, the wooing of Eva, the woman who did eventually become his wife, that involved him playing a harp, or what was it called, a clavos.
Yeah.
which is the small Irish harp.
A small Irish harp. Luring people in.
Have you seen the big Irish harps? They're ginormous.
They're big. They're big.
They're almost bigger than me. Yeah, and then there's the story of Yutain.
Yeah.
That's a fun one. A lord of the Tuatha De Danann took a fancy to Yutain and put his fairy wife aside, and obviously Yutain fell for him because his music was beautiful. But his wife wasn't very, his first wife was not happy about this whole sort of I divorce you bollocks.
Yeah.
And couldn't take revenge on her husband, so took her revenge on Yutain. Yutain actually means jealousy. So you can tell that story's not going to go well. Yutain gets turned into various different things until eventually she's turned into a fly, and the first wife conjures up a wind to blow her away. And weirdly, the story just sort of stops there. Which is a bit, she gets blown into the other world and then the story stops. Like someone's forgotten to write a verse.
And that's it. That's how it ends.
Right, this is what happens. If a fairy lord takes a fancy to you, you're basically screwed.
Yep. There's no way out. You're in trouble. But yeah, so we have all these examples of music being used to entice people in. You also have the banshee as well, who wails, but sometimes is it's heard as singing as well in some versions.
Yeah, they sing the lament, so it can sound like wailing when it's a warning. Yeah. But they've also lured people to their death in peat bogs with their beautiful song.
So in other words, if you're walking alone in the woods and you hear a beautiful song, maybe put your headphones in.
Yes. Basically, it's not going to go well for you. Conversely, musicians are also abducted into fairy with more regularity than others.
Yes.
Of both genders, it doesn't really matter. This is partly to do with the fact that the Lounge will actually feed on musicians, and they act as sort of, they're psychic sex vampires that act as muses.
Yeah.
The musician attains real greatness with their craft, but lives a very short life. But other fairies often make mortal musicians, if they're any good, very welcome in fairy. And it's generally an accident if they only get back to the mortal realm 10 years later or 200 years later.
Yeah, because actually music is something which will gain you favour with the Tuatha De Danann and the fairies in general. There's other examples of the story of the hunchback who has this terrible, terrible lump on his back which has caused him pain all his life. And as he's walking through the forest and he sits down to rest and he hears a song from a group of small little fairies who are singing all together, and he listens to it and they're stuck on the same refrain. And they're going over and over and over again. And so he's just sitting there listening to it, enjoying it. And he basically sings a response.
Yeah.
And they're so delighted by this response, they take away his hunchback. They take away the huge lump that has formed on his back. So they take it away and he's able to walk upright from then on. Another hunchback comes to him and says, "How did you do it?" And this guy's a bit not very nice, apparently, and is really just not really willing to really do anything or be a proper citizen and stuff like that. And so the first guy tells him, and he goes off and he waits for to hear the fairy singing, and he interrupts them.
Ooh.
And doesn't sing well. And so they punish him by taking the other guy's lump and putting it on his back as well, which ultimately kills the second guy. So...
Fairies, man.
Fairies. These are not pleasant stories. They're not very nice. And yeah, it's the idea that good music will earn you favour with supernatural beings because, again, it seems to be its own currency.
Yeah, and that probably reflects how you had a weird status as a bard in the fact that generally you would travel in order to make songs. You might recycle tunes and things, but you had to be extremely good at pulling things into a song, literally on the spot, if necessary. It was interesting. They were generally welcomed at most households, and you could expect bed and board in return for entertaining the household.
Yeah,
but it wasn't But it wasn't a very stable career because not very many places wanted to actually employ a bard full time.
Yeah,
and certainly once you got old and couldn't really travel so much, and perhaps your fingers weren't quite so quick on the harp strings, or your voice was going, because your voice does change as you get older.
Mm.
Even really well-trained voices, you get to a point where you can't hit the same notes that you could do in your youth, and you know, you have to either adapt or your voice disappears completely.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. But you could, if you were incredibly good, walk into a court and pretty much name your price temporarily. Yeah. It wasn't especially stable.
Yeah.
And then they had, following on from bards, you had troubadours and jongliers. Troubadours are particularly interesting because they were devoted to the Virgin Mary, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a continuing form of goddess worship under the umbrella of Christianity.
Yeah.
So they were Marians. They were followers of Mary.
Yeah.
Which is where you get things like Alain O'Dale from Robin Hood, who was really a troubadour, not a bard.
Yeah.
And then you had jongliers as well. This is more sort of 11th, 12th century, 13th century. And it really reflects the divide between Britain, where we were sort of talking French and sort of talking Anglo-Saxon, and really it depended where you were in the country at the time. France, because it didn't have this massive cultural divide at the time between two nations that didn't really like each other that much, was making great strides ahead of us in terms of architecture and art and poetry.
Yeah.
And this is where you got the jongliers. And they did actually travel as far as Britain as well. And sometimes they were welcomed and sometimes they weren't. But the weird thing is, you could be from almost any economic background. If you had found somebody to take you on and train you as a bard,
yeah,
then you had your own status. And before that, if you think, we almost had a caste system where you did not rise out of your caste.
Yeah.
So if you were born a serf, then you were going to die a serf and your children would probably be serfs. They might be freemen, but they weren't going to get much higher than that.
Yeah.
But if you happen to have natural talent and an older bard took you on because he or she would make a lot more money out of, for a lot longer, out of training you and taking your wages for a time until you were fully trained.
Yeah.
Then you'd kind of hit an uncertain jackpot, really.
Yeah. So there's the, I guess, the cultural, that's not the right word, but, you know, there's the practicality of musicians and the status that they did have for a long time in history and still do have, though I don't think music is appreciated quite as much anymore.
It depends on the type of music, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, you definitely can't just turn up to an establishment anymore and just say, please, let me entertain you, because we have, you know, CD players and speakers, and you don't end the radio and CDs.
I suppose the thing is, it depends who you are, because we do still make gods out of musicians.
We do, very particular ones though.
The gatekeeper is quite high.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the gatekeeper is quite select. High is not the right word, because some people, I'm thinking, how on earth did you make a career in music? It's like, if we took the mixing studio away from you, I'm pretty sure you would sound significantly worse than that.
Yeah. Problem is that it's no longer just about music, it's about the way you look as well.
It is. I think an element of character and being able to emote comes into it as well, because you can have someone with a perfectly nice voice who just cannot do that tiny bit of acting that's required as well.
Yeah, I agree. So let's actually look at some examples of actual characters who have that musical ability and who use music for storytelling. And I do kind of want to start with Unveiled, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Just spring that on you. Obviously, Emmeline within Unveiled is an excellent musician, and in book two, spoilers, she meets Lucas, who is another musician.
Possibly even more exceptional.
He's an incredibly exceptional musician, and both of them are supernatural in their ability, and I think that plays in a little bit with their musical ability. Certainly in the case of Lucas.
Well, I mean, yeah, in fairness, Lucas has had 200 years sitting in the Vale thinking about musical theory. So.
He's had a lot of time to think about it. And he's had a lot of time to practice as well, and to really hold on to his skills. And he's a natural musician. It's something that he was born to. But it's not just musical theory for him. There is an element of emotion as well. And the thing that attracts him to Emmeline's music, and I say that about Emmeline's music rather than just Emmeline in general, that's a different conversation. But the thing that attracts him to Emmeline's music is that when she auditions in book two, she actually gets overwhelmed by emotion while she's playing.
Yeah.
And she's carried off somewhere. And Lucas is just totally entranced, I guess, in some ways. We don't see it from his point of view, but I think that's the moment for him where he recognizes that he wants to work specifically with her.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he's got issues with her technicality on certain things.
Yeah, he's got a lot of issues with her technicality. But she's got that thing beneath it all, which he wants. And that is her ability to tell a story with her music.
Yeah.
And they actually use music from then on in all the books, actually, to communicate with one another and to actually communicate little side and little stories as well.
Yeah.
In fact, there's an entire point where they have a conversation through music.
Yes. Which sounds, if you haven't read the books, like really, really dull, but it's actually quite funny.
It is. It is a funny little sequence. So, yeah, I really, really, really like the way that you use music within the books. And I like the way that it's related to that supernatural element and has that extra kind of layer to it that means it is onto itself another form of communication.
Yeah, I mean, that it was something I was going for, because if you like folk songs like I do, or just music in general like I do, really, really good music works on lots of different levels. It works on a level where someone can go, that's a really nice tune, I'm enjoying listening to it, and it's just pure pleasure, pure entertainment.
Yeah.
And then there's the level where it tells a story. And then there's the level where it really tells you something about yourself, because you start asking yourself why you're responding to it.
Yeah.
And what it means to you. So it tells, you know, an obvious story and then perhaps a secret story that only means something to you, in the same way that the best storytellers can.
Yes. And the best poets as well.
Yes.
And we're back again that poems and music and stories are actually all from the same mixing bowl.
Yeah, definitely.
So looking at Emmeline actually as a kind of a bard character, she is a bit of a bard character.
Yes, because she has great difficulty communicating, whether she's stuttering or not, the rest of the time, particularly if it's something emotional,
mm-hmm.
because she's not, I would say after the first book, she's not as emotionally shut off, but she finds that a little bit sort of off-putting.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have so much trouble communicating that way through music, so that's kind of where her guard comes down. And the converse of that is that music has a lot of influence over her. So she probably gets manipulated a lot by Lucas because of music. And she doesn't really realise until the fourth book just how much power he really has over her, because he commands the same language.
Yeah, it's a little bit Phantom of the Opera-esque.
Yes, it is.
But yeah, it's the fact that she doesn't stutter when she's singing.
No.
She doesn't stutter when she's singing. So something which has gotten in the way of her being able to communicate in the past is removed by the fact that she's singing. And also, as you say, is that she actually deals a lot with her feelings and the things that she can't convey through music. So when she's annoyed, she goes straight to that piano, or she goes straight to the violin, and she'll pick it up and she'll just wrangle out a tune or two.
Yeah, it's being able to say everything she can't say, because obviously the more angry or upset she gets, the less she can get words out. So it's a really good outlet for her.
Yeah. She also can't read as well. And she gets able to read very slowly throughout the series until she can. But she's lost her ability to read in the way that she was able to once before.
Yeah.
But her ability to listen to music, I think, is almost heightened in comparison.
Yeah. And I've never really specified, but it always feels, which is a weird thing for me to say since I wrote the books, it always feels to me that as her as her psychic ability gets heightened, so does her musical ability, so that they're almost twin, you know, opposite sides of the same mirror.
Yeah, exactly. And they do feel very interlinked because music does come into it on several levels. Book three actually has a singing antagonist, as it were. Well, I say singing. She's not really an antagonist, but she's an antagonistic force, that's for sure. And we have the whole mermaid mythos coming in as well. And storm singers, you know.
Yeah.
Using your voice to control the weather. I love that. I really, really love the connection between singing and nature. And the idea that through song, you can actually control nature. And on some level, you kind of get that in Disney as well, because you get all these, the princess starts singing and the animals flock to her. You know?
Yes, or you know, you have the Little Mermaid, and it's almost like she's resuscitating Eric by singing to him, which obviously she's not, but it's a very interesting connection that he is waking up to her voice.
Yeah, and then you have Elsa from Frozen.
Again, that's a very primal.
And it's very, very primal, and yeah, for several emotional songs, that's when she really performs her biggest magic. So, I mean, obviously those are just visual representations, because you're kind of not meant to believe that they're actually just singing and dancing, and that's not really how life begins. It's just meant to show you an idea. But regardless, we have this idea of the connection between singing and the environment, and actually being able to control the environment, again, because song is so alluring and singing well is so alluring that it will even compel nature to listen to you and obey you.
Yeah, I mean, there's Hindu creation myths whereby the world was sung, literally sung into existence.
Yeah.
And that there are nine sacred notes, basically.
Yeah.
And we each respond to one particular note.
Yeah.
And it's echoed in things, weirdly, that sort of thing's echoed in things like sci-fi. So that you have the whole voice in operated by the Bene Gesserit in Dune, mm-hmm. whereby if they hit the correct pitch, they can take control of you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it has to be tailored to the right person. Mm. And there's been some, you know, various experiments done on that in real life, on just producing a pitch of sound that would cause people to, you're going to laugh, but lose bowel control.
Yeah, yeah, the brown note.
Yeah, the brown note. Because it's really difficult to fight when your trousers are full of shit. This is not the voice of experience talking, but, you know, I can imagine.
Yes. Yeah, because vibrations. And there's a science behind that as well, that certain vibrations will actually cause your body to react in certain ways. So it's not actually unfeasible to say that there is an element of control that can be done through singing. Also, yes. Because of the way that we respond emotionally to song, it can take us back somewhere. I mean, I've been in the car and a song's come on and I get over the hill and the sun is just setting and it hits that right part of the song and I just burst into tears, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It really is a very emotional kind of thing. And so I really like the stories where you have someone who's aware of that, the power of that music, or becomes aware of the power of that music and really starts to use that to effect. Because I think in a lot of literature recently, we've had a lot of kind of bard characters who are used for the comic relief. Because they're also the jokers. And it takes away from the power that we used to have that was associated with music in the past, in that this was the ultimate thing. It was the ultimate weapon. Music was dangerous to the point that actually poets and musicians in Irish mythology were not allowed to have children. I think we've covered this before. I'm sure Jules has already said, but we're not allowed to have children because they were too powerful and forbid.
Yeah.
They gave birth to someone that was even more powerful.
I mean, if you think bards were initially trained by the Druidic colleges, and okay, the Druids weren't actually that nice. You know, we see them portrayed in fantasy now and they're really quite clean living, ascetic type people who were keepers of the law. There was a lot of, for lack of a better word, blood magic and some very disturbing practices going on there as well. So let's not pretend that that all wasn't going on. But at the same time, there was this amazing body of lore and song that were taught to bards, and they had real command over producing beautiful music, and they trained their musicians for decades to get them to the pinnacle, and they started them really young as well, so sort of four or 5 years old. So it was genuinely a way of serving the gods, and as you say, that made them incredibly powerful political players, because you can influence a king's decision with the right song.
Yeah,
you can get in and get the king's ear with entertainment in a way that other people can't, and music brings your guard down as well. So yeah, as you say, they were not allowed to have children. You didn't want to start up a dynasty.
No. Because they were far too powerful.
Side note, cats. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just me indulging my love of cats. I know it could be, but it's not. We were talking about the fact that certain sounds can have certain effects on the body and things. Cat, we still don't really know how and why cats purr. However, cats purr quite often when they're in distress as well as when they're happy. And it is proven that cats purring help their cells to regenerate faster. So if they're healing, then their purr actually helps them heal faster.
Yes, I have heard that, which is also why sometimes they will curl up around other animals that are injured and purr very loudly.
Yeah, so there you go. Cats, basically witchcraft.
Witches! It all comes down to witches. And yes, cats are mystical and strange creatures.
I want to just, while we were talking, sorry, I've sort of looped away and back again, but while we were talking about bards as political players, I just want to talk about the Nordic tradition of skalds, who were incredibly, incredibly clever people, generally male, and they could read. But I mean, if you've ever tried to literally read the runes, not as a divination type thing, but literally read Nordic language, it's extremely complicated.
Yeah,
and a lot of it is to do with context, because it resembles our alphabet, not at all.
Yeah.
And they did learn vast bodies of lore as well, in the same way that other bard and druidic colleges did. But what they were especially good at doing was formulating poetry on the spot to suit a situation. And you wanted a skilled skald, try saying that fast.
A skilled skald.
On your team, if you were a jarl or a king, because you could get people on side really, really quickly. If you think of today's stand-up comedians who hit incisively on a political topic and actually make you reevaluate that political topic because they're funny and they're clever with it, that's kind of what the skalds did. Yeah. And they won a lot of people over because, I mean, kings were elected. That's the thing to remember. So you need it. It wasn't a case of, well, tough, I was born king, so you can all sod off. It was a genuine case of, no, I'm your elected king and I need to keep you on my side.
Yeah.
So that I don't get overthrown by someone killing me. So yeah, a skald was very definitely a politician. So yes, they controlled. They were like chief whip, but with poetry.
It's the fact that you see so many people today who are like, oh, singers shouldn't get involved with politics.
And you're like,
or sort of actors shouldn't get involved with politics. And I'm like,
it's nothing but politics.
It's seriously, yeah. A lot of music, especially rock music and things like that. I keep seeing tweets of people just saying, you know, responding to Green Day saying Trump is rubbish. And people responding sort of like, oh, you know, I loved you. I've been a long time fan, but now I won't listen to any more of your music. I'm like, clearly you weren't listening to any of their music at all to begin with. Because seriously, so much music is political. It's so political. It's politically leaning. And you get that in art, and you get that in so many different respects. And it's the idea that if you're an artist, you're not actually involved in politics. Whereas actually, historically and truthfully, art is very, very politically based. Writing is very, very politically based. Now, I'm not saying that that means that you should run for president. But I am saying that actually most artists have strong philosophical opinions about their chosen politics, And they express them very, very clearly a lot of the time. Books are political. All books are political in one way or another, either by being unpolitical or being very political. Well, but they have an agenda, really.
Yeah. I mean, you might have, you as an author might not be deliberately writing something that's supposed to challenge the mores of your time, but what you write will be reflected or will reflect of the time it was written in.
Yeah.
And when people say, well, I really liked the book, but I just don't like the author's politics, what they're actually saying is, I found their politics to be contrary to mine, and I wouldn't normally have noticed.
Yeah.
And it's the same with music. So when people are like, oh, yeah, it's just, I mean, yes, there are groups and there are individual singers where the song is clearly just sort of trotted out. It doesn't really say anything. And they're put together literally to be a sort of 2-year wonder to make money for a production company.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to have an argument there and say, you know what, these are not political players, that's fine. But there, you know, even in pop music, everything Lady Gaga's ever done is intensely political.
Yeah, very much. And rock particularly as well, you know, that the first periods of rock and things like that were politically based.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot of music which is politically based.
The Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, all of that was really subversive when it came out.
Yeah, it was.
And, you know, like we talk about folk music, it's all about sex and death and politics and you know, love, kind of. Yeah, but so's all music.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Even classical music.
Yeah. So there you go. Music and musicians tend to actually be quite political one way or another, or at least tend to have strong opinions about something, whether they are conscious of it or not.
Yeah. I notice you've been very quiet about your own musician characters, Madeline.
I do have a few musician characters, and I feel like I want to start by talking about Robin. Now, listeners, most of you will not know who Robin is. Robin is one of the characters from my middle grade children's book. I've mentioned a few times before, Anise Starr. And Robin is a musician who has gotten hold of a magical mandolin. And this mandolin basically allows you to tell any story with your music, so long as you can play it right. But it really, really basically stirs the listeners, and it kind of puts them in a trance, so that as you're telling a story with the music, they can see it like it's almost a spectacle, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So he has this mandolin, and it's his dream to go and perform in front of the emperor, because that was what his dad wanted to do, and his dad never got to do it because his father died. So he really, really wants to go and do this. And he has really been living the proper life of a bard. He ran away, and he's been going place to place performing to get money and then just traveling. And he's been doing it specifically to gather as many stories as possible so that he can write music. And he is very, very fun-loving. He's quite adventurous. He gets scared relatively easily when faced with things that he doesn't really know about, which is fair, to be honest. But his music is held back by one thing, that he says that his father was able to play music which could bring people to tears, and he can't do that yet. He can only play jollies, is what he calls it. So he plays very upbeat kinds of songs, and it's because he's not really, up until that point, been willing to deal with the loss that he's been through and his own negative emotions, because he really, really pushes them down. And so he's not willing to play, because in order to play it, he actually has to expose those feelings so that he can actually play this magical mandolin, which requires that level of emotion.
Yeah.
And the big part for him is actually letting go of his need to just have fun and actually looking at the reality of things and saying, to get beyond this, to get further, I need to actually expose who I really am. So that was a big part of his journey. And I really wanted to use the music there, because on a very personal level, I'm a musician, not necessarily a very good one, but I am a musician. And I definitely have used music and written music as a form of escape and as a form of expression for things which are hard to talk about face to face with anybody else. And it is a very difficult but also cathartic thing to do. And I really, really kind of wanted to look at that and really examine the not just the role of music in that, but actually the role of the creator behind that music and what it takes to create music in that way. So yes. I then have two other bard characters. I say two bard characters. I have a few musicians in the Hamartia cycle. Obviously, Rufus plays and sings, and Luca is an excellent fiddle player. But there is actually a bard character who is Howell. And Howell writes songs on the spot wherever he is. And there's just this one bit in the book where it basically just says that when Rufus broke up with him, Howell did the best thing, did the only thing that he was really... he really could, which is that he offered Rufus a drink and then wrote him a song on the spot.
You're horrible.
I know, but you love it.
I mean, I know I'm horrible too, but you really are. There's no excuse for you being horrible just because I am.
Yeah. But the idea as well is that Hal's a bit of a con man as well. He's a bit of a thief. And he's very good at acting. And that it was, again, the linking of the idea of storytelling and being able to put on a face that is less than honest. Yeah. And there was definitely a bit of an Alan a Dale kind of idea behind that, I think.
Do you know my... this is a bit of a sidebar. My favourite version of Alan O'Dale is from a book I read this year. I had an ARC copy of it. It's called The Forest Queen by Betsy Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And it's gender-bent Robin Hood.
Ooh.
So every male character is a female character in that. And it's Alanna O'Dale, who is this... I don't know, she's probably about my age in the book. And she's just this complete adventuress who is a bard and a bit of a swashbuckler. And, you know, just has all these bisexual relationships. And she's only in it for this, like, tiny fragment, but she's such an amazing character. So suddenly that character is so much more interesting.
I like the Anna Dale character, to be honest. I always have. I just think he's interesting.
Yeah.
We're actually out of time.
We are.
But before we go... it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And this week I'm actually recommending a book which I haven't finished yet, but comes highly recommended from Jules Ironside and from other readers. And that is Nevernight by J. Christoph. And I think probably the best description I can have for it is that if you were a bit disappointed by Sarah J. Maas's, what is it? Not Empire of Storms.
Oh, the Throne of Glass series.
Yeah,
I don't even think of her an assassin because she doesn't kill anyone. So she's just not, is she?
Well, yes. Yeah, so if you felt like actually that wasn't really a good series about assassins, you should definitely try Nevernight by J. Christoph. I particularly like the way that the narrator brings in little bits of information because he uses footnotes.
Which I loved the footnotes.
Yeah, the footnotes are very, very good. The narrator is very funny. It's got a good humour. It's got a good pace to it. So that's our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. Nevernight by J. Christoph. So do check it out. And also, please, please, please do leave us a comment and tell us about your favourite musical characters, whether you agree with us, whether you disagree with us. And I'm just going to hijack the episode very quickly for something which is totally non-Dissecting Dragons related. And just say to any listeners out there who are in the UK or who are around the Winchester area that there are a couple of ghost stories which are hanging around Winchester at the moment, run by Enigmatic Studios in the University of Winchester. So if you go to certain haunted locations, you will find these stories up on posters where you can scan the QR code and have a listen to them. And I did write one of them, so I really recommend that you check them out. First place that you can go to is the Theatre Royal in Winchester, and check out the Weird Winch hashtag. All right, so check out the ghost stories, tell us what you think about musicians, and we'll catch you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.